Chapter 7. The two were engrossed in the intimacy of their blended cigar smoke when the door opened and Varric walked into the room. Wythorn rose abruptly. It was the first time that Varric had come to the house, and the surprise of seeing him, combined with the singular inopportuneness of his arrival, gave a new edge to Wythorn's blunted sensibilities. He stared at his visitor without speaking. Varric seemed too preoccupied to notice his host's embarrassment. "My dear fellow," he exclaimed in his most expansive tone, "I must apologize for tumbling in on you in this way, but I was too late to catch you downtown, and so I thought..." He stopped short, catching sight of Ascot, and his sanguine color deepened to a flush which spread vividly under his scant blonde hair. But in a moment he recovered himself and nodded slightly. Ascot returned the bow in silence, and Wythorn was still groping for speech when the footman came in carrying a tea table. The intrusion offered a welcome vent to Wythorn's nerves. "What the deuce are you bringing this here for?" he said sharply. "I beg your pardon, sir, but the plumbers are still in the drawing room, and Mrs. Wythorn said she would have tea in the library." The footman's perfectly respectful tone implied a reflection on Waythorn's reasonableness. "Oh, very well," said the latter resignedly, and the footman proceeded to open the folding tea table and set out its complicated appointments. While this interminable process continued, the three men stood motionless, watching it with a fascinated stare, till Wythorn, to break the silence, said to Varric, "Won't you have a cigar?" He held out the case he had just tendered to Ascot, and Varric helped himself with a smile. Wythorn looked about for a match, and finding none, proffered a light from his own cigar. Ascot, in the background, held his ground mildly, examining his cigar tip now and then, and stepping forward at the right moment, to knock its ashes into the fire. The footman at last withdrew, and Varric immediately began, "If I could just say half a word to you about this business..." "Certainly," stammered Wythorn, in the dining room, but as he placed his hand on the door it opened from without, and his wife appeared on the threshold. She came in fresh and smiling, in her street dress and hat, shedding a fragrance from the bow which she loosened in advancing. "Shall we have tea in here, dear?" she began, and then she caught sight of Varric. Her smile deepened, veiling a slight tremor of surprise. "Why, how do you do?" she said with a distinct note of pleasure. As she shook hands with Varric, she saw Ascot standing behind him. Her smile faded for a moment, but she recalled it quickly, with a scarcely perceptible side glance at Wythorn. "How do you do, Mr. Ascot?" she said, and shook hands with him a shade less cordially. The three men stood awkwardly before her, till Varric, always the most self-possessed, dashed into an explanatory phrase. "I had to see Wythorn a moment on business," he stammered, brick red from chin to nape. Ascot stepped forward with his air of mild obstinacy. I am sorry to intrude, but you appointed 5 o'clock," he directed his resigned glance to the timepiece on the mantel. She swept aside their embarrassment with a charming gesture of hospitality. "I'm so sorry I'm always late, but the afternoon was so lovely." She stood drawing her gloves off, propitiatory and graceful, diffusing about her a sense of ease and familiarity in which the situation lost its grotesqueness. But before talking business," she added brightly, "I'm sure everyone wants a cup of tea." She dropped into her low chair by the tea table, and the two visitors, as if drawn by her smile, advanced to receive the cups she held out. She glanced about for Wythorn, and he took the third cup with a laugh. "Expiation, I can never," said Mrs. Fetherell, "hear the bell ring without a shudder." her unruffled aspect, she was the kind of woman whose emotions never communicate themselves to her clothes, and the conventional background of the New York drawing room, with its pervading implication of an imminent tea tray, and of an atmosphere in which the social functions have become purely reflex, lent to her declaration a relief not lost on her cousin Mrs. Clinch, who, from the other side of the fireplace, agreed with a glance at the clock that it was the hour for bores. "Bores!" cried Mrs. Fetherell impatiently. "If I shuddered at them, I should have a chronic ague." She leaned forward and laid a sparkling finger on her cousin's shabby black knee. I mean the newspaper clippings," she whispered. Mrs. Clinch returned a glance of intelligence. "Tea, they've begun already?" "Not yet, but they're sure to now, at any minute, my publisher tells me." Mrs. Fetherell's look of apprehension sat oddly on her small features, which had an air of neat symmetry somehow suggestive of being set in order every morning by the housemaid. Someone, there were rumors, that it was her cousin, had once said that Paula Fetherell would have been very pretty if she hadn't looked so like a moral axiom in a copybook hand. Mrs. Clinch received her confidence with a smile. "Well," she said, "I suppose you were prepared for the consequences of authorship?" Mrs. Fetherell blushed brightly. "It isn't their coming," she owned. "Tease their coming now. The bishop's in town." Mrs. Clinch leaned back and shaped her lips to a whistle which deflected in a laugh. "Well," she said. "You see." Mrs. Fetherell triumphed. "Well, weren't you prepared for the bishop?" "Not now, at least. I hadn't thought of his seeing the clippings." "And why should he see them?" "Bella, won't you understand? It's John." "John?" Who has taken the most unexpected tone, one might almost say out of perversity. "Oh, perversity," Mrs. Clinch murmured, observing her cousin between lids wrinkled by amusement. "What tone has John taken?" Mrs. Fetherell threw out her answer with the desperate gesture of a woman who lays bare the traces of a marital fist. "The tone of being proud of my book." The measure of Mrs. Clinch's enjoyment overflowed in laughter. "Oh, you may laugh," Mrs. Fetherell insisted, "but it's no joke to me. In the first place, John's liking the book is such a false note it puts me in such a ridiculous position. And then it has set him watching for the reviews. Who would ever have suspected John of knowing that books were reviewed? Why, he's actually found out about the clipping bureau, and whenever the postman rings I hear John rush out of the library to see if there are any yellow envelopes. Of course, when they do come he'll bring them into the drawing room and read them aloud to everybody who happens to be here, and the bishop is sure to happen to be here." Mrs. Clinch repressed her amusement. "The picture you draw is a lurid one," she conceded, "but your modesty strikes me as abnormal, especially in an author. The chances are that some of the clippings will be rather pleasant reading. The critics are not all union men." Mrs. Fetherell stared. "Union men? Well, I mean they don't all belong to the well-known Society for the Persecution of Rising Authors. Some of them have even been known to defy its regulations and say a good word for a new writer." "Oh, I dare say," said Mrs. Fetherell, with the laugh her cousin's epigram exacted. "But you don't quite see my point. I'm not at all nervous about the success of my book. My publisher tells me I have no need to be, but I am afraid of its being a success, a scandal." "Mercy," said Mrs. Clinch, sitting up. The butler and footman at this moment appeared with the tea tray, and when they had withdrawn, Mrs. Fetherell, bending her brightly rippled head above the kettle, continued in a murmur of avowal, "The title, even, is a kind of challenge." "Fast and loose," Mrs. Clinch mused. "Why yes, it ought to take." "I didn't choose it for that reason," the author protested. "I should have preferred something quieter, less pronounced. But I was determined not to shirk the responsibility of what I had written. I want people to know beforehand exactly what kind of book they are buying." Well, said Mrs. Clinch, that's a degree of conscientiousness that I've never met with before. So few books fulfill the promise of their titles that experienced readers never expect the fare to come up to the menu. Fast and Loose will be no disappointment on that score, her cousin significantly returned. I've handled the subject without gloves. I've called a spade a spade. You simply make my mouth water. And to think I haven't been able to read it yet because every spare minute of my time has been given to correcting the proofs of how the birds keep Christmases. There's an instance of the hardships of an author's life. Mrs. Fetherell's eye clouded. Dee, don't joke, Bella, please. I suppose to experienced authors there's always something absurd in the nervousness of a new writer, but in my case, so much is at stake. I've put so much of myself into this book, and I'm so afraid of being misunderstood. Of being, as it were, in advance of my time, like poor Flaubert. I know you'll think me ridiculous, and if only my own reputation were at stake, I should never give it a thought. But the idea of dragging John's name through the mire. Mrs. Clinch, who had risen and gathered her cloak about her, stood surveying from her genial height her cousin's agitated countenance. Why did you use John's name, then? That's another of my difficulties. I had to. There would have been no merit in publishing such a book under an assumed name. It would have been an act of moral cowardice. Fast and Loose is not an ordinary novel. A writer who dares to show up the hollowness of social conventions must have the courage of her convictions, and be willing to accept the consequences of defying society. Can you imagine Ibsen or Tolstoy writing under a false name? Mrs. Fetherell lifted a tragic eye to her cousin. Why, you don't know, Bella, how often I've envied you since I began to write. I used to wonder sometimes you won't mind my saying so. Why, with all your cleverness, you hadn't taken up some more exciting subject than natural history, but I see now how wise you were. Whatever happens, you will never be denounced by the press. Is that what you're afraid of? Asked Mrs. Clinch, as she grasped the bulging umbrella which rested against her chair. My dear, if I had ever had the good luck to be denounced by the press, my brougham would be waiting at the door for me at this very moment, and I shouldn't have to ruin this umbrella by using it in the rain. Why, you innocent, if I'd ever felt the slightest aptitude for showing up social conventions, do you suppose I should waste my time writing nests ajar and how to smell the flowers? There's a fairly steady demand for pseudoscience and colloquial ornithology, but it's nothing, simply nothing, to the ravenous call for attacks on social institutions, especially by those inside the institutions. There was often, to her cousin, a lack of taste in Mrs. Clinch's pleasantries, and on this occasion they seemed more than usually irrelevant. Fast and Loose was not written with the idea of a large sale. Mrs. Clinch was unperturbed. Perhaps that's just as well, she returned, with a philosophic shrug. The surprise will be all the pleasanter, I mean. For of course it's going to sell tremendously, especially if you can get the press to denounce it. Bella, how can you? I sometimes think you say such things expressly to tease me. And yet I should think you of all women would understand my purpose in writing such a book. It has always seemed to me that the message I had to deliver was not for myself alone, but for all the other women in the world who have felt the hollowness of our social shams, the ignominy of bowing down to the idols of the market, but have lacked either the courage or the power to proclaim their independence. And I have fancied, Bella dear, that, however severely society might punish me for revealing its weaknesses, I could count on the sympathy of those who, like you. Mrs. Fetherell's voice sang, Ave passed through the deep waters. Mrs. Clinch gave herself a kind of canine shake, as though to free her ample shoulders from any drop of the element she was supposed to have traversed. Oh, call them muddy rather than deep, she returned. And you'll find, my dear, that women who have had any wading to do are rather shy of stirring up mud. It sticks especially on white clothes. Mrs. Fetherell lifted an undaunted brow. I'm not afraid, she... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.